From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
New Orleans was victimized by more than Hurricane Katrina. We've been victimized by a whole neoconservative agenda of privatization, criminalization, and segregation.
6 months after Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, the city of New Orleans remains devastated. We'll speak with two activists who've been working with relief efforts on the ground. But first, to New Delhi, where tens of thousands have taken to the streets to protest President Bush's visit. We'll speak with acclaimed Indian author and activist Arundhati Roy. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In India, President Bush has signed a controversial deal to foster nuclear cooperation between the United States and India. Under the agreement, the U.S. would end a decades-long moratorium on sales of nuclear fuel and reactor components to India while allowing the country to substantially step up its nuclear weapons production. India is one of only three countries that has refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The deal was criticized by some lawmakers in Washington who said it could lead to the spread of nuclear weapons. House Democrat Ed Markey, co-chair of the bipartisan task force on nonproliferation, called the agreement, quote, a historic failure of this president to tackle the real nuclear threats that we face. We'll go to India for more on the president's visit after headlines. We'll speak with Arundhati Roy. Democrats have renewed calls for an independent investigation into the government's response to Hurricane Katrina. The calls follow the release Wednesday of confidential video footage from President Bush's final briefing before Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast. The president was given dire warnings the storm could breach levees and threaten the lives of residents of New Orleans. Yet days later, President Bush said the breach of the levees hadn't been anticipated. In other news, investigative journalist Murray Wass is reporting President Bush was personally delivered intelligence reports before the Iraq War that cast doubt on his administration's stated reasons for launching the invasion. One report, delivered January 2003, said Saddam Hussein was highly unlikely to attack the United States unless, quote, ongoing military operations risked imminent demise of his regime. Another intelligence report dated October 2002 said both the Energy Department and the State Department's Intelligence Bureau had concluded Saddam Hussein's attempts to purchase aluminum tubes were, quote, intended for conventional weapons. Wass writes the disclosure is, quote, the first evidence that the president himself knew of the sharp debate within the government over the aluminum tubes during the time that he, Vice President Dick Cheney, and other members of the cabinet were citing the tubes is clear evidence of an Iraqi nuclear program. Neither the president nor the vice president told the public about the disagreement among the agencies. In Washington, 15 activists were arrested outside the White House Thursday at a protest against torture. The protest was called by Witness Against Torture. In December, the group marched on the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where hundreds of prisoners are held without charge. Human rights attorney Jennifer Harbury was with the group in Washington.
So we wore the orange overalls and a gag that said torture, and we walked the halls of Congress to awaken their conscience. We're trying to haunt their conscience. We're the ghost walkers today. And we're here to say no human being can be tortured under any circumstances. My husband was tortured to death by CIA-paid assets or informants in Guatemala 10 years ago. And after many of my hunger strikes, that leaked out. And what we found out after it was too late to save his life is, like I say, they were all on CIA payroll. The Senate Intelligence Committee held a huge panel discussion and investigation of this. And after my testimony, they said, quote, this is a disgrace. No one should ever have to starve to stop torture. It will never happen again. And really, all of us are just calling them on that promise. There can be no more torture by the United States or anyone else.
That was human rights attorney Jennifer Harbury in Washington. Meanwhile, the wife of British Prime Minister Tony Blair has joined the calls for an end to the use of torture. In a speech and accompanying article on Wednesday, Sherry Booth said the use of torture in the so-called war on terror amounted to, quote, terrorism of the state. In environmental news, the Washington Post is reporting scientists have found the Antarctic ice sheet is shrinking by as much as 36 cubic miles a year. Researchers say the results published in the journal Science provide the first evidence that the sheet's total mass is shrinking significantly. Scientists said the decrease is likely linked to global warming. In other news, the New York Times is reporting the National Archives have directed intelligence agencies to stop removing thousands of previously declassified historical documents that had previously been available to the public. The program began in 1999 and intensified after President Bush took office. Documents that have been reclassified include intelligence estimates from the Korean War and reports on communism in Mexico in the 1960s. In the occupied territories, the Palestinian Authority has given back $30 million in aid from the U.S. government. The U.S. has demanded that none of its aid reach a government led by the Palestinian group Hamas. Israel has already halted its monthly remittance of $60 million in taxes it collects on behalf of the Palestinians. The aid refund comes as a new U.N. report is warning a donor freeze and the withholding of tax funds will lead to the shutdown of several essential services in the occupied territories. In the Philippines, President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo has lifted a week-old state of emergency. The measure was called after government officials said they discovered a plot to overthrow her. It allowed the government to ban rallies and arrest dozens of people without warrants. Police occupied the offices of the opposition Daily Tribune newspaper last weekend. Representative Teodoro Casino, a politician accused of involvement in the alleged plot, said, quote, "We still have a lousy president and the military and police are still after the enemies of the state. She lifted it to escape the snowballing protest against the proclamation," he said. Back in the United States, the Senate approved the renewal of the USA Patriot Act Thursday. The final vote, 89-10. In Mississippi, Governor Haley Barbour said this week he would probably sign a bill that would ban most abortions in the state. The measure would allow abortion only if it would save a woman's life. It makes no exception in cases of rape or incest. In Kenya, the government is coming under heavy criticism for staging a police raid against Kenya's second biggest media group. The raid forced CCTV off the air for several hours. It comes days after the station's sister newspaper, The Standard, published stories critical of the government. This is Rafael Mutila, an employee of The Standard newspaper.
All of us are told to lay down. Okay, then, meanwhile, after around 2 minutes, okay, they ordered us to take all the newspapers to outside there, where they forced us to burn all of them.
That was Rafael Mutila, employee of Kenya's Standard newspaper. And in Chicago, a proposal to erect a tribute to slain Black Panther Fred Hampton is drawing opposition from local police. Hampton was assassinated by the Chicago police in a December 1969 raid on his home. Chicago has nearly 1,300 honorary street signs. The president of Chicago's Fraternal Order of Police said the city shouldn't honor someone who advocated violence against police officers. But alderperson Madeline Haycock, who proposed the street naming, said, quote, "If you read the history of Fred Hampton, all he said is he was going to defend himself against policemen, and evidently he didn't because they murdered him." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush and the Indian Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, signed a controversial deal on nuclear cooperation Thursday between the United States and India. Under the deal, the U.S. would end a decades-long moratorium on sales of nuclear fuel and reactor components to India while allowing the country to substantially step up its nuclear weapons production. India is the only one of three countries that has refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The deal was criticized by some lawmakers in Washington who said it could lead to the spread of nuclear weapons. House Democrat Ed Markey, who co-chairs the Bipartisan Task Force on Non-Proliferation, called the agreement, quote, "a historic failure of this president to tackle the real nuclear threats that we face." Meanwhile, John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, defended the deal, saying, quote, "India and Pakistan had never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and therefore they weren't in violation of it by having nuclear programs." Bush arrived in India late Wednesday in his first trip to the country. He was greeted the next day by various branches of the Indian military. After Bush reviewed the troops, he told reporters, quote, "I have been received in many capitals around the world, but I have never seen a reception as well organized or as grand." But on the streets, Bush was greeted by mass protests across the country. In New Delhi alone, tens of thousands of demonstrators took to the streets. Crowd estimates varied from 250,000 to 700,000. The president's three-day stop to India included a visit to Mahatma Gandhi's memorial in Rajat. Bush is due to arrive in Pakistan later tonight, where he's due to hold talks on Saturday. While he's scheduled to meet in Islamabad, the Financial Times reported he may make an unscheduled visit to the southern city of Karachi following Thursday's suicide bomb attack outside the U.S. consulate there that killed an American diplomat and at least three others. We go now to New Delhi to speak with the acclaimed Indian author and activist Arundhati Roy. She is author of a number of books, including The Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire, The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile, and her Booker Prize-winning novel, The God of Small Things. Her latest article is published in The Guardian in Britain, The Nation in the United States, and the website called Bush in India, Just Not Welcome. We welcome you, Arundhati Roy, to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. Your response to President Bush's visit?
I must say that it's been one of the weirdest times I've lived through, because on the streets you have these hundreds of thousands of people protesting, and we have a government that's being so obsequious that it makes your skin crawl, and we have stories in the corporate press in India which are unbelievable. About how Bush arrived with 16 dogs that are staying in a five-star hotel and are not to be referred to as dogs because they're actually officers of the U.S. Army. We have stories about, the front page story today in the major newspaper is about Laura goes shooting with Boomba the bear and Anchu and Chumki. And the front page story is why Bush missed his dessert at the banquet. And this whole nuclear deal, obviously, which sounds to me a bit like, I hate to be so rude, but, it sounds like sort of pimps negotiating how somebody should act with their client. You can sort of sleep with her, but you can't kiss her. It's all theater. The whole thing about whether the fast breeder reactors would be included or not and so on, because everybody knew that there was no other way but this. And really, it's a cover for all sorts of other deals that are being signed. And yesterday on the street, while I was there, there were, 53 widows from my state of Kerala, of farmers who've committed suicide because of the closing, net of debt around them. Tens of thousands of farmers have committed suicide. And yet, he arrived here with these corporates like AES and Cogentrix and Unocal. All of them have such dubious records. It's really unbelievable. And yet, if you see the way the CEOs and the corporates are fawning over him. And I have to mention this, that they couldn't find a public space in India for Bush to speak. So he ended up, the meeting was organized in the Delhi Zoo, in the walls of the Purana Qila, which houses the Delhi Zoo, where he was going to speak to some rich people and some corporate people. But because the parliament refused to have him there, the Red Fort was surrounded by, Muslim population. It was too dangerous. Vidyan Bhavan was rejected as being not good enough for him. So, and you have today American soldiers on our streets preventing my friends from going into their own homes because Laura Bush is going to drive past to have pictures taken with some orphans. And it's just unbelievable. The whole city is shut down. I can hear helicopters flying around over my head.
Arundhati Roy, you were in the streets in Delhi?
Yes, of course I was.
What were you doing?
I was there. There were two, in Delhi, there were demonstrations on 2 days continuously. You know, there was one was basically called by the Jamaat Ulema Hind. It was like a huge demonstration. Then yesterday it was called by all the independent people's movements, the left parties and other main political parties. Everyone was just furious, you know. And yet, if you looked at the Indian news, you know, the major corporate Indian news, it is as if they never happened because everybody's just so busy. Even the heads of television stations who were invited to the lunch with Bush, whether in the garb of journalists or corporate captains, they weren't sure. So they come out of this lunch and they are being interviewed by their own employees as if they are sort of corporate heads. And everyone, and on every channel, they are telling you how Bush touched their hand or put their hand around, you know, his hand around their shoulder, his arm around their shoulder. And it's as if the demonstration didn't happen. It's unbelievable. In the English press, I mean, that's not the English press.
If you could explain again, he did not address Parliament because people there would have protested?
First, the government wanted him to address a joint session of Parliament, which Clinton did when he came. The MPs threatened to heckle him and embarrass him. So that was not possible. Then they said, okay, can he speak at Vigyan Bhavan, which is this sort of official stuffy auditorium in Delhi? But that was, you know, considered too much of a come down for a man of his charm and radical intellect. So then they said, okay, can he speak at the Red Fort, which is from where the Prime Minister gives his, you know, Independence Day speech? But that was too dangerous because it's in the old city and it's, you know, full of Muslim terrorists, as they must have said. So then finally they said, okay, he's going to be in Purana Kila, which is the old fort, which has the Delhi Zoo inside. It's a very beautiful old fort. But it was really interesting because the Ministry of External Affairs denies any responsibility for this meeting. Then the Chamber of Industry and Commerce said, that, you know, we didn't call the meeting. Then they found that the meeting had actually been called by the American ambassador. But then the Federation of, the Indian Chamber of Commerce and Industry said, no, we've called the meeting, so the ambassador's cards are invalid and they will, you know, guests who he's invited won't be allowed in. So, you know, on the face of it, there's all these people fawning, and yet they don't know what to do because they're so scared of him appearing anywhere except in these, you know, hugely exclusive hotels. He's booked the whole of the Moria Sheraton, which is the most expensive hotel in India, and the Meridian where his dogs are living. And it's just crazy.
Arundhati Roy, what about the visit to the memorial for Mahatma Gandhi?
Well, you know, the memorial for Mahatma Gandhi is now becoming the favorite visiting spot for all kinds of, you know, war criminals. You had Ariel Sharon go there, then you had the Burmese dictator go there, now we have Bush. And when Bush went, apart from the fact that even in advance, people were really upset about the fact that he was going there. Even though, you know, I mean, some of us, I mean, speaking for myself, I'm not a sort of unquestioning fan of Mahatma Gandhi, but still, many people are, and he is the symbol of nonviolence in India, you know, and to have this man coming there. And then they sent in the dogs. First, the dogs went in to sniff out, you know, whether somebody may have buried a bomb in the memorial. And then he went. So, you know, on the whole, I think almost when Bush leaves and the government and the press, particularly the television and the mainstream newspapers, kind of just get a moment to look back and see what they've done and how they've behaved, I think it's going to be shameful, you know, because people are really, really angry.
Arundhati Roy, we have to break four stations to identify themselves. We're going to come back and also talk nuclear politics. We're speaking with the acclaimed author and activist Arundhati Roy in New Delhi. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush is in India. He says it's the grandest visit he has had in terms of reception. We are going to New Delhi with Arundhati Roy, the acclaimed author and activist. Among her books, Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire, The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile, War Talk, and her acclaimed international bestseller, The God of Small Things. She has written an article in Britain and the United States, one called Bush in India, Just Not Welcome, and the one in The Guardian in Britain, Baby Bush, Go Home. She, too, was in the streets with Arundhati. How many people do you estimate were in the streets?
Well, you know, actually, Amy, it's difficult for me to estimate because I was in there, you know, like I didn't have a perspective. Like I couldn't, you know, climb a tree or something to see. So, I mean, the demonstration that I was in, I think there were about 60 or 80,000 people. And the previous day, it was even more than that. Because, you know, I mean, it's a nice thing about India that there are so many, there's such a variety of people, and sometimes they have differences with each other. Like the Muslim organizations that actually call the demonstration, they were not, it's not that they were sectarian organizations, but, you know, they were obviously outraged about the whole cartoon controversy, and it was combined. And some people had slightly nuanced views about it, you know? So there were different days, different people, but still at all times there were hundreds of thousands of people out there on the streets.
And what specifically?
In, Bombay as well as Delhi as well as everywhere else.
And what specifically are people protesting about President Bush?
Well, in you know, in many, in, basically, I think it falls into two categories. One is just the Iraq war and the, you know, the terrorism that is unleashed on the world. But in India, you know, the fact is that the economic policies of Indian government, which, you know, this whole neocon world which Bush embodies, actually has more of a resonance because, you know, really, I have to say this, that the real impact of all this is in the villages in India, and there people are too poor to even, you know, really miss a day of work and travel to a big city to protest. So it's just not possible, you know. But the impact of these policies is what the Congress pretended to be against when it was campaigning in the election. And then as soon as they won the election, they just reverted to, you know, the usual corporate policies and privatization and everything. So, you know, that's the thing. That these are, it's a double-pronged thing. And that's why I think it's very important for us to understand that this nuclear deal that's being talked about, it's not just that. You know, it's really the umbrella for a million different other kinds of deals that are going on, which will make it impossible. You know, the Indian government is negotiating India into a corner where, you know, you're not going to be able to you're trying to pretend that you're making some equal deal, but actually you're signing, you're a fish who's signing a deal with an alligator. You know, it's not an equal partnership by any means. So,
Arundhati, one of the ways the media is characterizing this protest is saying you know, hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of Muslims have taken to the streets. Mm-hmm. What is your response to that, seeing it as a sort of Muslim protest that then people can understand what the demonstrations are about?
Well, it is true that hundreds of thousands of Muslims took to the streets, but that was only one part, you know. There were hundreds of thousands of other people, too. And those, that's why I'm saying there was such a diversity of protests, because those were on separate days. They were on separate days, like the protest that I was at wasn't that, you know. And besides, I don't understand why we should continuously be separating them. You know, Muslims are also people on the street, you know, and they're a huge percentage of India's population. So, but of course, the important thing in this is that the, you know, one reason why the India and the U.S. began to kind of cozy up was that this whole war on terror was sort of dovetailing in to the communalization of India, which was begun, of course, earlier by the Congress and brought to a peak during the regime of the BJP. But in states like Gujarat, for example, it's like Nazi society there now. You know, the Muslims have been ghettoized, they are economically boycotted. You know, there are a few big cases of those who were killed in the 2003 sort of pogrom. But otherwise, it's a nasty, frightening situation. Hundreds of, you know, some 150,000 driven from their homes. And that's all happening in India today, you know. So the Bush administration is also dovetailing into that bedrock of trying to create a communal divide.
We're talking to Arundhati Roy, who too was in the streets protesting President Bush's visit. President Bush also went to Hyderabad, a hub of information technology. The New York Times reported Bush told an entrepreneur there, quote, people do lose jobs as a result of globalization, and it's painful for those who lose jobs, he said. Can you talk about the significance of this trip?
Well, you know, first of all, to go to a country which is, you know, basically a rural economy and talk about jobs is really strange. But second of all, you know, since the so-called economic reform regime began, the number of farmers that have committed suicide is in the tens of thousands in India. And in Andhra Pradesh, is one of the states worst hit by that. So Bush, now the Indian government, is talking about the fact that Andhra Pradesh is overrun by a radical armed struggle, Maoist armed struggle. You know, every year 200, 300 people are killed, you know, disappeared in what they call encounters in Andhra Pradesh. And the previous chief minister, his car was blown up. He escaped with his life. He lost the elections because he used to refer to himself as the CEO of Andhra Pradesh, not as the chief minister. You know, so it's ridiculous for him to come and say things like it's painful. In India, you know, while they talk about this new big economy and the Sensex has crossed 10,000, they forget to mention that 1.1% of Indians have stocks in the stock market. And all these farmer suicides, they're not counting, of course. Women committing suicide are not counted as farmers because the land isn't in their name. There's a sort of garroting of the rural economy. Then there's a whole business of trying to take over, you know, the seeds, corporatize agriculture, make everybody somehow beholden to the corporates, which is something that's going to result in mayhem here.
President Bush heads from India to Pakistan tomorrow, and there is a report he might go to Karachi, where the suicide bomb attack occurred Thursday outside the U.S. consulate there that killed an American diplomat and at least three other people. Can you talk about the significance of the trip to Pakistan as well, and then this unprecedented deal that the president is making with India around selling them nuclear fuel and reactor components that would end this decade-long moratorium?
Well, look, nobody seems to have been suffering from the decade-long moratorium. So I don't know why we're acting as if it's some terrible thing, some terrible prison that we are being released from. My position when India conducted the nuclear test was that, you know, that now that you've done this, you're going to have to play by their rules. So it's not actually that you're freeing yourself, but then you're selling yourself into kind of nuclear bondage. And this is exactly what is happening, that you're no longer able to to make any independent decisions, because you're just going to, it's just like an orchestra. You know, if you see, I've just been watching how the whole thing was scripted, you know. You see that Volcker Committee report that came out about, you know, about who had broken the sanctions and dealt with Saddam Hussein. First of all, you know, that just set the tone for the fact that the sanctions were right and whoever broke them was wrong. The External Affairs Minister in India had to resign because actually he was the one that put the spoke in the wheel of Indian troops being sent to Iraq. Then the Minister for Petroleum was chucked out because he was trying to do the petroleum deal. Then the King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia sent here, you know, to say, no, you can take oil from us. Then the Indian Prime Minister has a kind of roundtable conference about Kashmir with people who all agree with him anyway. So, you know, it's not really anything. But the U.S. Prime Minister mentions it in his Asia Society speech. Then we have this whole drama about fast breeder reactors being included or not included. Then all of us know that that was all going to happen when he came here. So the theater is over now and the conquest is complete. You know, that you are going to now play by the rules. And there are so many points of contact that if you disagree about one thing, pressure will be brought on from the 99 others to make you fall into line. So that's the situation. Pakistan, of course, is an old ally of America's. And, you know, I keep joking about it. They're like two begums in the bush. In the Sheikh Bush's harem, you know, vying with each other for his attention. And that's the situation as I see it.
Finally, Arundhati Roy, you're headed to Pakistan, not to follow President Bush, but for the World Social Forum that will be taking place later this month. Can you talk about what you'll be saying there and the significance of this forum on the heels of this visit?
Well, actually, I'm not headed there because I know that my name was announced, but that was done without anybody asking me. And, you know, I'm really thinking about all these things too much to be able to go and speak at the World Social Forum now, because I'm very worried about, you know, all of us who are involved in these things spend too much of our energy sort of feeling good about the World Social Forum, which has now become very NGO-ized and, you know, a lot of it's just become too comfortable a space. And I think it played a very important role up to now, but now I think we've got to move on from there. And I've already said this at a previous World Social Forum talk. And I really don't want to, you know, carry on doing something when the time is over for it, you know. I think we have to come up with new strategies.
Well, Arundhati Roy, I want to thank you very much for being with us and speaking to us from New Delhi. Arundhati Roy is the acclaimed writer and activist, has written a number of books, including The Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire, The Checkbook, and The Cruise Missile, War Talk, a book of essays, and what she is most well known for around the world, The God of Small Things. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR, Low Power FM, college and community radio stations, and also on PBS and public access TV stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410, Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also there in Spanish, and any radio station can pick them up. And we have our transcripts online at democracynow.org, so you can send them to friends around the world. As we continue now in this country, Democrats have renewed calls for an independent investigation into the government's response to Hurricane Katrina following the release of new video showing the Bush administration was warned of a catastrophe. On Wednesday, the Associated Press released confidential video footage of President Bush's final briefing before Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast. The president was given dire warnings the storm could breach levees and threaten the lives of residents of New Orleans. Yet days later, President Bush said the breach of the levees had not been been anticipated. The news comes 6 months after Hurricane Katrina ravaged the Gulf Coast in what many call the worst natural disaster in U.S. history. The storm displaced some 770,000 residents, destroyed over 300,000 homes. Nearly 2,000 people are reportedly still missing in Louisiana alone, at least 130 of whom are children. In the city of New Orleans, whole neighborhoods remain obliterated. In New Orleans' hardest-hit areas, such as the Ninth Ward, there's still no power or running water. Meanwhile, Wednesday, hurricane evacuees and nearly 3,000 hotel rooms nationwide were faced with a dreaded choice: either remain in their hotel and pay the bill with their own money or other federal assistance, or check out and find a new place to live. It was the last day FEMA directly paid hotel bills for many evacuees outside Louisiana and Mississippi. Storm survivors in about 7,400 hotel rooms in those states have been granted another extension through at least March 15th. We're joined in our Firehouse studio by two people, by Jordan Flaherty, an organizer with the New Orleans Network, longtime activist and editor of Left Turn magazine. Jordan was in New Orleans when the hurricane hit in August. He returned to the city soon after being evacuated to help with relief efforts and to report on what was happening in the streets, particularly in poor Black communities that were most affected by the hurricane. And we're joined by Kevin Powell, longtime activist, journalist, hip-hop historian. Kevin traveled to New Orleans the week after the hurricane. Hurricane is currently helping to launch Katrina on the Ground, an initiative which will bring student delegations from around the country to the Gulf Coast to work with local aid organizations. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Well, Kevin, let's begin with you. What are you doing?
Well, you know, we saw that, with the exception of a lot of local folks like the brother sitting right here, a lot of our so-called national leaders have been really missing in action. I'm talking about elected officials, people who run civil rights organizations, et cetera. And as we were responding to Katrina with the benefits, folks going down there and whatnot, we said, you know, we need to do something that's going to be very significant, and probably in the sense of what happened in the 1960s, where you had a lot of students going down there. A lot of college students were asking us, what can we do? And so we put together Katrina on the Ground, and we have about 1,000 students coming down. I know there were other students already down there, but this is actually going to start on Sunday in Selma, Alabama. We're going to train them every Sunday and Monday in Selma, and then they're going to go to Biloxi, to New Orleans, and to Mobile, Alabama.
So this is for their spring break?
This is an alternative spring break, and part two, God willing, will be Freedom Summer 2006. We've been talking to a lot of people about that. I certainly want to get your information, because this is something that we feel has to bring the spotlight back to what's going on. I mean, we were just fighting here in New York City the other day with the 9 families being kicked out of the Kensington Hotel. Luckily, we got to stay, but you're absolutely right. This is a problem that's going on around the country in terms of social justice not being done for these displaced victims, particularly poor people in this country, and we're not going to settle for that.
Jordan, talk about on-the-ground efforts right now in New Orleans, the different groups and the different issues.
I feel like I learned a lot about what community means by living in New Orleans, and there's a lot of amazing organizers, folks from what I would say is the Ella Baker School of Organizing,
that's
who
right.
came up out of that movement and have inspired me so much and taught me so much. Great organizers that work with the People's Hurricane Relief Fund, Common Ground Collective, Insight Women of Color Against Violence is starting a Women of Color Resource Center down there in New Orleans. Really amazing organizers who are doing really fabulous work. And folks from around the country who have come to support us, which has been really inspiring as well. And that is what's inspiring, which we need, because we are let down by the federal government,
Absolutely.
By the state government, by local government, by the corporate media. All those folks let us down. You know, Bush knew. We didn't need to see that videotape to know that Bush knew. Scientists knew, journalists knew. It was in our local paper. It was on television stations. Everyone knew the levees were in danger. Everyone knew that we needed to do coastal restoration to protect the city. And Bush did nothing. He cut the funding for coastal restoration. He cut the funding for shoring up the levees. He did not care. And that's why, you know, we need to do for ourselves and stand up and fight back.
What are the key issues that people are organizing around on the ground right now?
Well, I'll tell you who had a fast reaction time is the Heritage Foundation, the right-wing think tank. Within about a week and a half after the hurricane, they put out their agenda for their hurricane relief. And they said, we need to cut the capital gains tax. We need to cut the inheritance tax. And they also said, we need vouchers for schools. They're attacking our school system. They're attacking our healthcare system. They're attacking public housing system. It's this whole neoconservative privatization agenda, and we're being hit with it really hard. We had in Louisiana, it might might be surprising for people to know, we were the only state in the country with a statewide health care system specifically for poor folks, the Charity Hospital System. And Charity Hospital in New Orleans serves 66% of the uninsured folks in the city. That hospital was closed down under Katrina. Doctors went in, cleaned it out. They say the hospital is ready to be opened, but the hospital, the state is not reopening that hospital. The school system, we had 117 schools. There's now just a handful open. Most of them have been charter schools or students have been given vouchers. We are facing what looks to me something very similar to the end of open access public education in the city. It really looks like that. The vast majority of the teachers have been fired. For some students, things are going to get better because some of these students are going to get into charter schools, which will be improved. And let me tell you, our public school system was not beautiful to begin with. But some students are going to get left behind. They're going to be in the very few schools that are left, and it's going to get even worse for them. Housing, public housing. There are several thousand units of public housing that were not damaged, and yet they still have not been opened. Our at-large city councilman, Oliver Thomas, said the other day, we don't want any soap opera watchers in these. The Housing Authority of New Orleans is going to set up testing. The people have to have job experience and training to go back into their homes, the homes that they used to live in. And, you know, we say, what about the elderly? What about caretakers? What about women with children who, you know, isn't that work if they're caring with kids? Apparently not to Oliver Thomas. So people are being kept out of public housing. And that's a tragedy to me. It's painful to me. 6 months later, these units still sit empty. B.W. Cooper Housing Projects, after 5 months, they actually got broken into. And we might not find out who did the massive break-ins and stole people's stuff, but the fact is, if people had been allowed to come back into their homes, there would not have been that widespread robbery.
We have to break, but we'll come back to this discussion. Jordan Flaherty, longtime activist, editor of Left Turn magazine, organizer with the New Orleans Network, and Kevin Powell, longtime activist as well, journalist, hip-hop historian, organizing spring break for hundreds of students coming from around the country and perhaps a new Freedom Summer 2006. Stay with us.
Big chief coming on, go nowhere.
Shallow water, go mama.
Say big chief coming on, go nowhere.
Shallow water, go mama.
They raising hell, they say everywhere.
Shallow water, go mama.
They open and holler, y'all let them come.
Shallow water, go mama.
Say big chief coming on, they won't run.
Shallow water, go mama.
They meet everybody with a feather in his head.
Shallow water, go mama.
They print on face, paint is red.
Shallow water, oh mama.
They whooping and hollering, jumping up and down.
Shallow water, oh mama.
They mean this big shape we gon' climb.
Shallow water, oh mama.
They be over here by the bank street.
Shallow water, oh mama.
We got the suit, they gotta be.
Shallow water, oh mama.
Oh, the sun is shining, it's really hot.
Shallow water, oh mama.
I don't know much longer, I'm gonna keep this rock.
Shallow water, oh mama.
Scenes of Mardi Gras Indians this week in the streets of New Orleans. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. That's right. This week, Mardi Gras celebrations did fill the streets of New Orleans at around half the numbers than usual. Every year, a group of African-American residents dress up in elaborate Native American garb to pay tribute to the Native Americans who helped blacks during slavery. Democracy Now! Producer Anna Nogueira was in New Orleans on Fat Tuesday. She spoke with Big Chief Alfred Doucette in the 6th Ward at the Backstreet Cultural Museum. He talked about the Mardi Gras Indians.
The Mardi Gras Indians, you know, like this is our tradition, you know, we do this thing on Mardi Gras. You know, we do this as a tribute to the Mardi Gras, to the Native American Indians for the time when, you know, slaves were trying to be free and they was running around trying to find a place to hide, and the Indians took them in and gave them shelter. And this is a tradition that we try to keep going. Just more or less giving back to the Indians, you know, because, like, you know, the Indians is about what and what with us, with the suffering and, you know, the humility and all the stuff that they went through. You know, we went through pretty much the same thing. And, you know, that's, you know, we try to keep going, you know, just pray. You know, like, thank you. You know, thank you for helping us to get to this point, because we could have died off back in the days. But, hey, here we are. This is 2006. After Katrina. New Orleans is in trouble. We lost so much. A lot of our people haven't come back yet. And our culture is thinning out. You know, people are trying to hold people everywhere. For those of us that's back in New Orleans, it's happening. We're making it happen. You know, this is my tradition. This is my town. I was born and raised here. I love New Orleans. New Orleans is in trouble, and it's in trouble by man's hand. And man needs to fix this problem. And I don't see what's taking them so long, because it ought to take us some money. You know, like Bush need to get off his hands and just go ahead and say, hey, before another catastrophe happens, we need to go ahead and give us this money. Let's go on with our lives, put our lives back together. We're going to spend the money back into the economy. I don't understand why they won't give it to us. I need a house. They gave me a trailer. I don't want a goddamn trailer. I want my house back. And, you know, he just need to get off his hands and say, well, I'm going to go ahead and give this to you this money. Let him go build a house. Let him go buy a house. Let him go on with their lives before another catastrophe happens. And, you know, it's going to happen. I'm 65 years old. My life was set. And I was comfortable. You know, whatever years I have left, I would love to enjoy them like I was before Katrina. First Katrina, then come FEMA. I don't know what storm it was.
Where did you live?
I lived in the 8th Ward. My street was 2608. North Russia Blade Street. I've been staying over there 4 years. I bought that house, renovated. I dressed it up. I thought I was set for the rest of my life until Katrina came. But I'm not really blaming Katrina, because if the levees wouldn't have fell down, I'd have been home a long time ago in my house. But the people that was hired to do their job didn't do their job. And by them not doing their job, they displaced a million or so people from their home because of one person didn't do his job. One person. That one person was bigger than a bomb. Look what he did my city. You got to come around my house. I had 6 foot of water in my house. 3 feet stayed. 2 weeks. I got a brown line in my house. It's racism. It's prejudice. It needs to stop. We need to come together as a people, because this city is screwed up. And ain't no one race of people gonna fix it. They can bring all the Mexicans in there they want. But if they don't bring my people back in there, the walls is not gonna be fixed. New Orleans need to be fixed by the people that made New Orleans. And my people are scattered. They're out there. And they need to get them back home to fix New Orleans. We need this Mardi Gras more than any Mardi Gras we ever had. This town is dead. My area, 6, 7, 8, 9, east, is dead. You can count the people that's back in my neighborhood. And they got place for my people to be in my neighborhood. But they're not allowing the people to come back. They're keeping the gas out. They're keeping the electric out. I came on and bought me a generator. I lived on a generator for 3 weeks. $20 a day. That didn't last too long. Money wasn't that long. You know, everything I accumulated in 65 years I've been here, I lost it. But I got my life. I got my health. I have a roof over my head. I have a few dollars in the in the bank. Still waiting on FEMA to do what they're supposed to do. I need money to live. Everybody needs money to live. This town needs money to live. Okay? We got people come from everywhere in the country bringing money to this town. We need those people to come here, to deposit the money right here in New Orleans. The merchants, the business people can put it back into New Orleans economy. We need them to come. No, we don't have nothing to really celebrate people in New Orleans other than asking the people to come here to help us get our town back together.
Big Chief Alfred Doucette in the 6th Ward at Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras Indians, African Americans of New Orleans, honoring the Indians who helped the slaves more than a century ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. He was speaking with Democracy Now! Producer Anna Nagara. Our guests in the studio are Jordan Flaherty, who is working on the ground with various community organizers, and Kevin Powell, longtime hip-hop activist, historian, journalist, helped launch Katrina on the Ground, an activist in the New York area who's working to bring students to New Orleans. And Kevin, I wanted to ask you about up here what is happening to the evacuees in the hotels. You mentioned that you were trying to stave off evictions.
Well, you know, this has been going on for the last 3 or 4 months. There's a group that we've been working with called Family Dynamics. There's a New York City coalition that's supporting evacuees who are here. And just the other day, got an urgent call that 9 families are going to be evicted from the Kensington Hotel, which is right on the border of Queens and Brooklyn. Literally, people are scattered all over the city, as
near
you can
Kennedy
imagine.
Airport.
Exactly. And so, you know, we got a stay of that eviction, but God knows this is a week-to-week process. And part of the problem, as Jordan was alluding to, there seems to be this kind of Katrina fatigue in this country from the top down, where folks are not very supportive of these people. They don't understand that there's a difference between charity, giving one time, feeling good about it, and justice, which means this has got to be something we do ongoing, because we're talking about issues of race and class in this country, and the fact that these people's lives are not valued because they're black, because they're poor, you know, because they lived in the Ninth Ward, because they lived in places like Iberville. And so, you know, part of Katrina on the Ground is to say we're going to bring the spotlight back to this thing. And you know, this is going to go on for as long as it's necessary. And we see this incredible intersection, and I'm sure Jordan would agree with this, between what happened to these residents, between the fact that you have on March 14th, you may notice veterans coming down who are against the war in Iraq, but also in support of what's going on down there on the ground. The fact that we see the reproductive rights of women being attacked. And so we feel like this is an opportunity.
What do you mean
time.
The reproductive rights of women?
Well, I mean, it's starting now. You know, state by state, we can see the fact that...
In general.
Yeah, Roe v. Wade being eroded. And so what we're trying to say to people is not just about Katrina, it's not just about New Orleans. This is about democracy in this country, and we needing to bring all these different social justice movements together. Otherwise, it will continue to be this kind of isolated thing. You're doing your thing, I'm doing my thing. We're saying, no, this is a serious, serious time we're living in. And clearly, as was reflected in that video by Mr. Bush a couple of days ago, these folks absolutely do not care what happened down there.
Jordan Flaherty, the color of New Orleans now.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing American racism on hyperdrive right now with the mass dispossession of people from New Orleans. I'm white, and most white folks I know are back in New Orleans. Black folks are not back.
Right.
Even if you compare similarly destroyed neighborhoods like the Lower Ninth and Lakeview, right?
Absolutely.
Lakeview is mostly white, and people are coming back by and large. People are rebuilding. The Lower Ninth, you know, is not back. And so it's definitely, you know, It's a racialized disaster.
And the voting last week, a federal judge ruled against a request for the state of Louisiana to create out-of-state satellite polling places for evacuees temporarily living outside Louisiana. New Orleans is scheduled to hold a primary election in April. What does that mean? They
exactly.
don't participate in the rebuilding of their city.
Exactly. I mean, I'm not a big believer in electoral politics, but one way that you dispossess people of a city is you take away their voting rights. And we were able to allow Iraqis living in the U.S. to vote in the Iraqi elections, but we can't allow the New Orleans people dispersed around the U.S. to vote. And this idea, oh, they can do absentee balloting. If you're moving from place to place to place, then you're not in one stable address, and that's what almost everyone from New Orleans is facing. They can't do the absentee voting. They can't do that. So we need satellite voting, and it's being stopped.
And real quick, 6 months after you're away from a resident, you're no longer a resident in a lot of ways in this country, in that particular area. And so these folks probably won't even have the right to vote in New Orleans, because it'll be more than 6 months when April comes around. And so we're talking about folks not even being able to participate in who's going to be the mayor and city council for that city.
What about the prisoners? We were focusing on this a lot after Hurricane Katrina hit. First, what happened to those who were incarcerated at the time that the water was rising in the prisons? But what about where the prisoners are today, Jordan Flaherty?
We still have at least 3,000 that are locked up in maximum security prisons around the state. And these are people who still have not gotten a lawyer, still have not been convicted of a crime. This is the kind of thing we condemn Guantanamo for, right? But it's happening right in Louisiana. In fact, of the 42 public defenders, there's only 7 left right now. And they can't take the cases. In fact, a judge has ruled.
What do you mean only 7 left?
The rest have all been laid off. The cities didn't have money for them. So there's and those that are left, a lot of them don't have phone service, fax service, the things they need to properly represent their clients. So these people are not getting representation. They don't have any time on the horizon, the chance of even having a court hearing. And I want to remind the Law and Order viewers out there that just because someone's been arrested doesn't mean they're guilty. Just because they're convicted doesn't necessarily mean they're guilty. But definitely these folks have not been convicted of any crime. They have not had their day in court. They're just being shuttled off to these prisons. And it breaks my heart. Many of the people who were in misdemeanors have just gotten that now. So these are people who were there for public drunkenness or unpaid parking tickets. They spent several months without getting their day in court. It's heartbreaking to see, and it's being ignored.
And
where
are these prisoners?
They're at Hunt's Prison, Angola Prison, which is a former slave plantation, where 90% of the prisoners there end up dying there. It's, for death penalty and life in prison places. People still do the plantation labor. They still cut sugarcane there at that prison. And that's where far too many young black men from New Orleans have ended up historically. And I want to give a shout out to Safe Street Strong Communities, which is a coalition of groups in New Orleans that are working on this issue and organizing on this issue. Organizations like Critical Resistance, criticalresistance.org, and people can see more of those organizations at the magazine I work for, leftturn.org, which also has more coverage of that, also neworleansnetwork.org, and I also want to say reconstructionwatch.org has had a great coverage of breaking down the facts, something called the Mardi Gras Index of all these facts on education, prisoners, healthcare, all that.
If people are diving for their pens right now, we'll link it all at democracynow.org. But what about public schools and also the universities? Tulane opened up, but there were also the historically black colleges that were hit very hard.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have seen such it's heartbreaking for me to see on every level the way our education system has been hurting. But one thing that's interesting I want to say about Tulane is 90% of Tulane students came back. Now, people keep saying that we have to be realistic, that New Orleans people don't want to come back, they won't come back. These students who had much less of a link to the city, they came back because they were welcomed and they were encouraged to come back.
Yeah.
The people of New Orleans have been kept out. Dillard, which is a historically black college, still 80% of those folks came back.
It's absolutely untrue that people don't want to come back. We've talked to residents all around the country. They just don't know how they're supposed to get back. They don't have the information. They have this sense that they're not wanted back in their communities. And as he said, this is a whole racialized natural disaster, and the response has been racialized. And one thing I need to add is that what's been frustrating for us as organizers of Katrina on the ground is the fact that foundations, corporations, certain people who call themselves leaders in this country, be it elected officials, civil rights leaders, have completely turned their back on the fact that there's no plan, no real plan to help these people down there.
Your website, Kevin?
KatrinaOnTheGround.org.
And the students head down?
March 5th, Sunday, March 5th to Selma for training, and then they're going into New Orleans, Biloxi, and Mobile, and they'll be going on all month, and as I said, part two throughout the summer of 2006.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, and we're going to follow what those students
do. Thank you.
Thank you for keeping the coverage alive.
Jordan Flaherty, longtime activist and editor of Left Turn magazine. Kevin Powell, longtime activist as well, currently helping to launch Katrina on the Ground. All the links to the organizations that have been mentioned will be on our website at democracynow.org. And special thanks to Anna Nogueira, who is in New Orleans this weekend. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Abdel Kadouche, John Hamilton, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. Monday, Michael Eric Dyson will join us. Wrote the book, Come Hell or High Water, The Color of Disaster. I'm Amy Goodman.